Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Yeah, it's a five-alarm fire, and we're the dog of that meme sitting there saying everything is fine. Well, hello, and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show about the future of transportation. I'm Patrick George, editor-in-chief of Inside EVs.
And I'm Tim Levin, senior reporter at Inside EVs. We've got a lot to talk about this week. As always, Tesla's board is reportedly looking to replace Elon Musk. Waymo and Toyota are teaming up to develop self-driving cars. And Patrick just got back from China. We'll spend most of the episode talking about that country's super advanced EV market. And judging by Patrick's slacks to me over the last few days, how America is kind of screwed here. But first, how's it going, man? Are you like, you had a huge long flight, big time difference. Are you like with us right now?
You know, I'm super normal, man. I'm great. I woke up at 4 a.m. today, and that's definitely not going to come like bite me in the ass at some point later this afternoon. It was like, I live in a tiny town in upstate New York, and like 2 days ago, 36 hours ago, I was in Beijing, China, and just like, it's just a bizarre that like that's even possible somehow, thanks to the miracle of air travel and whatnot. I also left on April 29th and I came back on April 29th, making this like the world's worst form of time travel.
Yeah, you were like texting me. It was clear you didn't know what day it was in America.
Yeah,
it was hilarious because yeah. You were on the plane. There's an insane time difference, which was just hilarious.
Yeah, it was, I was just like, yeah, pretty off that whole weekend, exhausted and trying to like, I like downing some Ambien. I bought it at a Japanese airport so that, you know, I could sleep on the plane. And I was also trying to book a hotel in New York City because I got it at midnight, and that led to a lot of shenanigans too. So it's been a week, and I can't wait for the weekend, but, we got a lot to talk about, man, about China and all kinds of things. Let's start with Tesla. Let's start with our man Elon and a bombshell story that dropped last night, right? Like, what do we got?
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal dropped a bombshell report Wednesday night saying that Tesla's board of directors contacted executive search firms about a month ago for a replacement for Elon Musk.
Yeah, pardon my French here, but this is a holy shit moment for Tesla.
Yeah, totally. This is something that, you know, has kind of been talked about in hypotheticals, like what would happen if Elon Musk, you know, left Tesla or was pushed out of Tesla. But it's kind of hard to overstate how intertwined like Elon Musk is with Tesla, the company.
Yeah,
he has run the company since 2008. He's been seen historically as extremely important to its success. But now with sales of Tesla falling, the stock falling, and Musk spending most of his time working in government, it seems like the board is considering a change.
Yeah, it is. I can't undersell like how monumental this is for Tesla. It's like there's two things that come to mind for me here. One is, at least in my mind, as a fellow journalist working in this industry, like, the Wall Street Journal is as good a newsroom as you get in this country. Their word is up there with like the AP and the word of God in my mind. And you know, stories like this, like, get legaled to hell and back, and that they triple check their sources and stuff. So like, this came from a serious outlet. And, you know, we're seeing today, like, Tesla, its board, Elon on X, like, scrambling to dismiss it and discredit it in just like this real state of panic that I think, at least in my experience, usually this means you got the story right when you hit this level of, like, you know, intensity at the company. And two, you know, this is wild because like this board at Tesla has been accused of rubber stamping everything Elon does, of absenteeism, of cronyism, you know, sort of getting just rich selling the stock while he does whatever the hell he wants. Like, that has always been the criticism of the Tesla board. It's like, they can't mess with the golden goose at all, and they're getting very wealthy. And at any other company by now, the stuff that we've seen with Tesla, sliding sales, you know, the controversies around Doge, the controversies he creates in general, like any other CEO would have been spiked by now, but not him. And it's like, if they're really acting now, or had some kind of come to Jesus talk with him, or they're really actively thinking about like who could lead this company that's not him, that's a really big deal. A really, really big deal.
Yeah, for sure. I think absolutely any other CEO who has acted like any one of the things that Elon Musk has done in recent years probably would have led to the downfall of any normal auto or tech CEO. I mean, we should mention the board of directors says this is false. Elon Musk has also denied it. But like you say, like, I mean, maybe this is a bit of a tangent, but I think one of the really problematic things as a journalist that I see from Elon Musk is just sowing this kind of distrust in the media. And like, I'm getting on my soapbox because this is not related to cars, but like,
yeah,
you know, Elon Musk went out there and said that this story was deliberately false. And we know, working in this industry, that is just simply not true. Like,
yeah,
when an outlet like the Wall Street Journal, or for that matter, like the Washington Post, the New York Times, or the Associated Press, when they put out a story citing anonymous sources, you know that they did a lot of work to make sure that that was airtight. Like, there are obviously always, there can be issues in reporting, but to say that this is deliberately false is just completely wrong. Like, you should, the public can trust. When the Wall Street Journal puts out a story that says this thing happened, you trust that there are 100 other things that they were told and they were tipped off to that they did not include because they could not verify. They could verify.
Yeah, yeah. And just like, I'll tell you from personal experience right now, less so at Inside EVs, but other places that I know and have contributed to even, like, newsrooms are very nervous about the power that Musk has and the power that Doge has. Like, if you're gonna like fire this bullet, like, you better be damn sure. And I just know that, like, you know, again, as like a fellow industry professional, like, they were sure about the bullet when they loosed this. So I see this realistically as more of like a course correction, like, hey, Elon, like get over here, get back to work or figure something out, as opposed to like, we're legitimately going to replace you with Carlos Tavares or somebody else with, like, you know, great auto industry experience or something. You know, like, I don't know how serious they would be. And this is really being hypothetical. Honestly, it's like, who would really lead Tesla if not him? You know, like, that's never been a serious consideration before, but it should have been. And now I guess it's about to be, maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, we should mention kind of the backstory here for Tesla. As we mentioned, sales are down. People are super turned off by Elon Musk. There's protests out in the street outside of Tesla stores. People are refusing to buy these cars. And this is not just happening in America. This is happening globally. And after years and years of super fast growth, last year, Tesla sales were down by a small amount. This past quarter, the first quarter of this year, Tesla's global deliveries down by about 13%. So they have real problems on their hands and a lot of big, ambitious plans that they are trying to accomplish. They have a robo-taxi launch happening in June, supposedly. And they have affordable
models. Next month, by the way. That's next month. Like, yeah. Not just like down the line. That's 4 weeks from now. Yeah.
Right. This is like the thing that Tesla and Elon Musk have kind of hung their hat on for years. They're like, we are going to be a gigantic robo-taxi company. And the start of that vision happens in a month. And at that same time, you have the board reportedly, I believe probably, looking for a replacement for the CEO who's been there for almost 20 years. It's a crazy time. I mean, is it the worst time, or is it maybe the best time to consider a replacement? I don't know.
It's worth noting that, like, this story in the journal corroborates things that we already know from Musk himself and from President Trump. On the most recent Tesla earnings call, like, Elon opened up by saying, like, he is going to return to Tesla, and he's kind of tapering down his time at the White House. And the other day, President Trump said, I think he misses his cars and his family, like, in that order, which I found really kind of hilarious. Like, he wants to get back to his cars and his family, again, in that order. The president has a real way with words. That's quite enjoyable. But they've been kind of saying, they've been kind of alluding to this, and now we have the sort of behind the scenes, what probably happened take. And I don't know where it goes from here, but I think a lot of it's going to hinge on this robotaxi launch in June and how that goes. And we'll see, you know?
And on top of that, maybe more importantly, since fundamentally Tesla's a car company, which we have to repeat often, Tesla is launching these quote-unquote more affordable models also in June, in the first half of this year. So we'll have to see how that works out and if that can, you know, juice sales. Otherwise, I think looking forward, who knows, maybe Musk is out.
Yeah, God, yeah. You want to do it? You could be a good CEO of Tesla, Tim. You should do it. How hard could it be?
I'm pretty busy with this podcast and everything.
Yeah, you do a lot around here. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, now let's we're gonna shift gears a bit and talk about a very interesting potential partnership that's cropped up this week. You wanna take it away, Tim?
Yeah, on Tuesday, Waymo and Toyota announced a strategic partnership aimed at developing personal self-driving cars. So we have the world's leading autonomous vehicle company, Alphabet's Waymo, teaming up with the world's largest car company by sales. This feels like a really big deal to me. It's also worth noting, they said in this press release that Toyota Woven, which is Toyota's kind of mobility subsidiary, is going to be a strategic enabler of the project, which leads me to my most important question. Who's your strategic enabler, Patrick?
I had a lot of friends in college. I would definitely describe that way. Thankfully, we've all grown up a bit since then. I have fewer of them now. But it was an interesting because they were very careful to say it's a potential partnership. It sounds like what TechCrunch said is like it's like they're dating. Like they're not settling down yet, but they are dating. But it's like Toyota is very serious about future technology, and they've experimented with autonomous vehicles before. Like they had an autonomous shuttle at the 2020 Olympics in Japan that took athletes to and fro. They've had a partnership with May Mobility on some other things, which I think they're going to keep going. So, you know, it's and also on Waymo's side, like they're working with a lot of other automakers right now. Like they're going to be deploying driverless Hyundai Ioniq 5s, and they confirmed to me that they're still working with the Chinese auto brand Zeekr, which we're going to talk about a little bit, to do like these kind of robotaxi buses too. And you know, there have been questions about tariffs and technology or whatever because it's Zeekr, but you know they're playing a lot of cards, like both of these companies. And I don't know, if you have Waymo teaming up with a player as big as Toyota, that could be quite a partnership, especially since they're talking about not just robotaxis, but how do we extend this stuff to personal cars to make the cars that you and I would own more automated and more self-driving, which is really interesting.
Right. We don't actually know exactly what's going to come out of this or if anything's going to come out of it, but it could be driver assistance technology or full-blown like self-driving technology coming to your next like Camry or Lexus. I think my takeaway is kind of like, this is another notch in Waymo's belt that just shows that it is completely running away with the autonomous vehicle race. Like it's basically not even a race. And you compare that to where Tesla is at. Like Tesla claims that it wants to be the leader, claims that it's destined to be the leader in robotaxi technology. And yet Tesla has been promising to sell you a self-driving car for over a decade. It never has done that, right? It sells a technology called full self-driving that you can buy for several thousand dollars, but you still need to pay attention to it as it kind of navigates the world and drives down the road. That's not self-driving. And then we have Waymo, or I guess The other thing to mention is that Tesla has talked for years also about licensing full self-driving to other automakers. This is one of the things that Wall Street analysts ask about on like every call. They're like, how's it going with licensing full self-driving to other automakers? Because this could be an enormous source of revenue if, like, you know, somebody like a Toyota or a Ford or a GM was like, you know, actually, we think Tesla's ahead here. We're going to just, instead of developing our own stuff, we're just going to license Tesla's technology, put it in our cars. And Musk and Tesla have been alluding to this for years, saying this is possible, saying they have people interested. Nothing has come of that.
Right.
And here we have Waymo teaming up with the biggest car company.
Yeah, it's interesting also, like the licensing thing, because for the longest time, the question to Waymo and Google has been like, what's the end game here? Like what, are you going to be a taxi company now? You Uber? Or is the play to like develop the best autonomous driving tech around and then sell it to other players or co-develop it with other players? And now it seems like it's the second one, which would be a tremendous revenue stream for Google, because like kind of right now, like Waymo is a loss leader for them. And we've all sort of wondered like, what do you do with this? Like, where do you take it? I'm excited to see where this goes. And I think that like Toyota has the capital and the scale to pull this kind of stuff off. Like I think they sort of realize that they are behind the curve on a lot of future technologies, but like the company you mentioned, Woven, it's like their connected software subsidiary. There's really smart people working there. I've seen some of their prototype stuff on like a trip to Japan I did 2 years ago. They want to not get left behind, and they're throwing a lot of money and smart stuff at it. So we'll see where this goes. But I mean, if your next Waymo car is a Toyota Camry or something, then this is going to be why, you know. I mean, all the cabs are already Toyota Camrys, like, you know, or RAV4s. it might as well, right?
Yeah, totally. And just quickly, I wanted to say, like, you know, I think this speaks to the difference between Waymo and Tesla. And I'll try to get to this quickly because we want to get to Patrick's China stuff. But like Tesla has always said, and Tesla kind of proponents have said, that their big edge here in robotaxis is scale, right? They're like, we're a car company. We're going to sell these relatively inexpensive electric cars with cameras and with computers in them. And we're going to sell millions of them. And then someday we'll make them self-driving and we'll just flip that switch. And we're going to have the biggest self-driving fleet in the world. It's going to be, you know, cost-effective. It's going to be profitable. That's what Waymo is trying to do too, but it's kind of starting from the other end. It's like, we're going to make the best self-driving car, and then we're going to figure out how to scale it, how to scale that business up, how to eventually bring the cost of the technology down, because you can't build that business on Jaguar I-Paces that cost like estimated between like, you know, $100,000, maybe $200,000 to outfit with all these crazy sensors.
Yeah.
That's kind of the different approaches here. And even on the recent earnings call, Musk was asked about Waymo and he made this like dad joke. He was like, well, they cost Waymo money. And that's kind of always been their position.
I'm so glad we've legalized comedy again. I just want to be clear about that. Thank God that, you know, we can say what we want and have brilliance like that, you know?
Yeah. So that's always been the argument for Tesla's technology, was like, it's easier to scale because we're building these cars that cost less money. And then Waymo's like, oh, scale? We've heard of, have you ever heard of this? You heard of this company called Toyota? Like, So it'll be really interesting to see where this goes and like who at the end of the day between these companies and the others, who builds the large scale, profitable self-driving car company that everybody wants to build.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. Let's move on to Patrick's trip to China.
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. You went to the Shanghai Auto Show this past week, and I understand it completely broke your brain. Is that accurate?
It absolutely broke my brain, and that's before the jet lag and the Japanese ambient at the airport. Fun anecdote very quickly. I was at Shanghai for a while, then I took a flight up to Beijing for an event we're going to talk about, but do you want to know what super advanced high-tech car picked me up on ride-sharing Didi in Beijing, took me to my hotel? Do you want to know?
Of course I do.
It was a Toyota Camry hybrid.
Ah, bummer.
It's like I flew 7,000 miles across the world, and it's like I could get this in New York City like any damn time I want. I just found that hilarious. But
were you walking through the airport like, oh man, I'm so excited to jump in like a Geely, you know, or whatever. I'm so excited for my Zeekr cab to autonomously shuttle me.
Yeah, the Zeekr mix or something. It's like, no, it's a Camry hybrid, and it's the same damn car you get back home, baby. Like, you know. Which was hysterical, but we were there. Kevin Williams and I were there for the Shanghai Auto Show. He's going to join us next week too, because he stayed a few extra days to drive more cars and has even more stories than I do. But this really was like the most eye-opening and insightful trip I've done in my reporting career. And I'll tell you that we have written for years. You've written for a long time, Tim. We've said in the podcast about how advanced China's EV sector is. It is one thing to hear that from your sources and the experts and people on the ground, and it is a very different thing to see it for yourself and to drive these cars. And there's about half a dozen I drove while I was there, and I just I'm left in awe of all of it, and also a little like terrified of just where the players that aren't China are at in this race. Yeah, I think besides just seeing the auto industry in a different way, you know, I think it changed a lot of the perceptions, at least I had, about China as a country, because we get a very filtered view of it here in America because it is an adversarial country in a lot of ways. And, you know, let's be honest, like that government does things that are we would consider objectively horrible. But the people themselves, lovely and kind and helpful and very nice. And, you know, honestly, they're a lot like Americans. Like, they love streetwear. They love KFC. You know, they have big sedans and SUVs they drive. Like, they're really into Marvel movies and stuff. And I saw like Western action movies like everywhere there. And when I got off the airplane at Beijing, like the first store I saw was like selling Marvel gear and Marvel toys and posters and things. It's like, okay, I'm, you know, that's just how much American pop culture pervades in the world. But like there's some things that they really jive with. So like, I think just issues with governments aside, it's like as a species, as people, like we're not all that different. You know what I mean? Certainly this country makes a lot of cars that feels like they could be successful here without much effort. And just above all, like China's EV sector, its hybrid game, its software game, it is light years ahead of the West. It just is. And I mean, I've seen this stuff up close now. I've driven it. These are the most advanced cars I've ever seen. And it is not a question in my mind of how we catch up, but if we even can.
Yeah, we've been reporting, everybody in the West has been reporting on how Chinese cars are like estimated to be like a decade ahead of the West's. And it is really cool that you finally got to actually experience that. But first, let's start with the show itself, the Shanghai Auto Show. We cover auto shows all the time. We go to them. How did this stack up to the American version of an auto show?
I think another quick anecdote was like, I came down at the hotel and I had like a, you know, just the typical PG professional outfit on, you know, like nice pants, a blazer, a button down, no tie. And I was wearing like dressy boots. And Kevin Williams looks at my shoes and he's like, no, just no. Like throw your sneakers on and thank me later. I was like, all right, cool, I did. And I'm glad I did, because this event is held at Shanghai's National Convention and Exhibition Center. It is 16 million square feet, or about five times the size of the Javits Center in New York City, where the New York Auto Show is, or about seven times the size of Huntington Place, formerly Cobo Hall in Detroit. So yeah, comfy shoes are key here. Last year, the last Shanghai Auto Show, 900,000 people attended during public days. 900,000 from every province of China. This year, they are expected to top that. So probably about 1 million people are going to go to it. More than 1,000 exhibitors, including the car companies. So, like, it was full of people, even during the media preview days. Full of people and full of cars. I mean, just the size of it was like nothing I have ever seen before. I've been covering auto shows for, a dozen years now. I mean, just like this is the size of China's auto industry and the scope of like the buyers that they have there. It is so big. And just like this size of it all is what helped them as a country move so fast. Like when you have a buyer base that big, you have a workforce that big, and they're so focused on engineering and STEM there that, like, you know, you get this is one of the biggest reasons they've been able to move and advance as quickly as they have. It's just like manpower, personnel, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, CES here is all tech. It's like TVs and microwaves and stereos. And then also there's like a car section. This sounds like CES, but just like all cars.
All cars, yeah. And car technology, battery companies and, you know, hybrid platforms, things like that. Like I walked 7 miles each day I was there, the 2 days I was there. And last time I did that, I was on vacation with my wife in Tokyo. So like that gives you an idea of how much is involved here.
That's crazy. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, like, what brands were there? There's obviously a lot of Chinese companies that we're aware of. There's also foreign companies that are trying to compete in that market. And for the record, one of the kind of big trends in the Chinese market, and one of the things we cover a lot, is the fact that Chinese buyers used to love Western brands like Volkswagen, GM, Audi, Buick, Porsche. These were the big popular sellers in China, and they still kind of like them, but not nearly as much as they used to. Like sales of those Western brands are falling, while all these new Chinese brands are just rising in the ranks, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like the problem is the GM and VW, those companies that you mentioned, they built their business models around like endless China growth, like they were having in the 2010s, and that's not there anymore. And now it's, oh no, like what do we do? So it was fascinating to me to see among the local crowds who was interested in what brands that were there. That was very telling. I went with Geely Group, which it is pronounced Geely, not Geely, by the way. I went with the Geely Group, which owns Volvo and Polestar in the United States. And it also the ones that they were hyping there were Zeekr and Link & Co., which are both going on sale and expanding in Europe right now. And they're kind of like Polestar-ish brands, like less Scandinavian minimalism and more just like EV performance. Like they're kind of like Kevin is calling them like the Chinese Acura, Chinese BMW a little bit. I think that's more or less fair. So I went with that company and drove a bunch of their cars. But, it was when you go to the show, it's like you have all these Chinese brands there. I didn't know what a lot of them were, honestly. Like I knew the big ones, the ones that we've written about, but there were so many others. And like, I'm not used to going on an auto show not knowing what the hell's going on. Like, you know, I've been around the block, but like to his credit, like Kevin Williams kind of knows everybody and everything there, and people come out of the woodwork to like shake his hand and talk to him because he's such a trailblazing reporter of like actually going over there and seeing this stuff for yourself. But like, you see who's interested in what, right? Like, a lot of folks wanted to see the latest BYDs or these Zeekrs or the Lincoln Co. vehicles, and Nissan and Mazda had a bunch of new stuff there that they're making with their Chinese partners. Like more and more these brands that aren't being competitive in China, they're going to their long time or even new partners in that country and being like, hey, like teach us how to make cars, teach us how to make high tech connected EVs for the Chinese market. And like Mazda had some great looking cars that I wish we sold here. And like, they were getting a ton of attention, like good for them. So is Nissan. But like General Motors, they had a Buick concept. Nobody cared. The Lincoln stand was empty. Only one of those cars is a hybrid. So I don't know why a Chinese person would want to spend a ton of extra money to buy a gas powered Lincoln there. But next to Lincoln, there was Li Auto, which is this luxury brand. It's kind of like Chinese Lexus, you might say. And they have this like super luxury minivan called the Li Auto Mega. There were lines to go see it. And that car has been on sale for a year. in China. And I'm like, I'm not getting a line. I'm getting a line at auto shows, but like, it was a hype machine still. That was just kind of crazy to see. Audi is launching a new brand in China called Audi in all caps. It's Audi by Audi. Yeah, it's very, very clever. You know what you're getting. And like, they're advertising the hell out of this thing. Like, ads for this car, it's called the Audi E5 all over China when I was there, like at the auto show and other cities. And it's being built with Volkswagen's longtime partner SAIC. It looks like a Chinese car. Like, it's like a wall-to-wall digital screen. It's super sleek. It's purple because they love purple cars in China. They're really just like, hey, like we're gonna do what you want. Like please buy it. And it had like a moderate level of interest with the people I saw there. So that was telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we should back up and talk a little bit about how this worked. Like how foreign automakers entered the country and how that kind of business model worked, because it matters. So for decades, basically, the Chinese government mandated that any car company that wanted to come in, any foreign car company that wanted to come in and sell cars in China, they had to partner up with a domestic Chinese brand and form a joint venture. So that's how Volkswagen and GM and Ford and all these companies were able to do that. And that was really successful for these foreign companies for a long time. But also over time, it means that, and this was, I believe, kind of the intention of that program, was that these domestic Chinese automakers learned a lot about how to make cars. They learned how to make cars, and they learned how to, and they especially, you know, learned how to make cars that Chinese buyers really wanted. And so that's kind of where we're at now, which is that they started out as partners. Over time, they learned how to do it better than the Western automakers or the other Asian automakers. And now you have the old guard looking to the new Chinese automakers to say, hey, how the hell do we build these cars? Like, you have Volkswagen partnering up with XPeng. You have Stellantis partnering up with Leap Motor. It's this really bizarre kind of, you know, total turn of events.
Yeah, and the Westerners, they're the junior partners now in this whole thing. Like, this, it's a story I actually want to write for Inside EV soon, is like how these tables have turned is crazy. And they printed cash together, and now they're not. And I think the big turning point was when Tesla entered China in 2017, and it did so without a joint venture, which had never happened before. And that did a couple things. That gave Tesla its Shanghai factory and Chinese sales. That gave Tesla long-term stable profits, which had eluded it for a long time. And it really kicked the EV market in China into high gear. Like, the Chinese were already moving that direction. The government wanted EVs, but like Tesla made EVs cool, is what somebody there told me. Like, they were just kind of like nerdy little, you know, BYD minivans before that. Now it's like everything is like sexy and hot. And like, they were like, this is where we're going to plant our flag for the future. And they took those ideas and ran with it. It's worth noting that China's national and local governments like heaped subsidies onto these companies and to buyers and to like municipalities to get them to buy these cars. Like, they really like incentivized the whole transition in ways that we haven't, like, make the IRA look like nothing, right? And it worked. So you combine that with a huge labor pool, cheaper labor costs, big focus on STEM education, engineering in China, plus all the know-how you got from Tesla and your former Western partners, and boom, like, this is new daddy, you know? And it was just kind of wild to see all that.
Yeah, it's one of the big things that we have to mention is, like, yeah, the reason, one of the big reasons that they were able to leapfrog the rest of the world so quickly is that, you know, they have this authoritarian rule. Like, they can be like, we are going to do EVs. Nobody will complain about it. We will give you tons of money to do so. We'll give, you know, customer, you know, buyer rebates. We'll give out loans and other investments to build up this industry. And that's what they did. Yeah. They spent, you know, somewhere around $250 billion, $230 billion over the last several years doing this. A lot of that went to companies like BYD, which is now the biggest maker of EVs in the world.
Right.
So let's talk about the cars themselves. What is the vibe of the Chinese car market. What do they look like? What do they feel like?
The way I would describe it is imagine Tesla, but more and better. Like dozens and dozens of like Tesla type companies that have taken that template, electric obviously, but like really dependent on like a touchscreen and software and over the air updates and, you know, certainly autonomy too. And they've just like ran with it in crazy ways. Like it, like you wouldn't believe. I mean, like we, the kind of the story for us in America, it's like the automakers we have, they're just now starting to catch up to Tesla and surpass them in a lot of ways. It's like everybody's already done that. Like they're way past that. You know, like these Zeekr cars, for example, like just like you get in, you maybe have a great little driver display screen. And then there's a bigger touch screen with like a 3D model of the car, and you touch different places on the car and it'll like open the doors or open the windows. Lots of voice commands and like AI built in that converses with you and like sings to your children and learns your preferences. And like, will be like, hey, I didn't really get what you mean. Can you elaborate on that last two things? Like DeepSeek AI is built into all the cars there. It's cliche to say like smartphone on wheels, but that's what it's like just technology wise. Like, I think it's fair to say the way I've thought about this is when you talk about software on in cars in America, it's like your car has like, it's like a media player with a navigation system. Like that's kind of it, right? Like this does everything. It'll book like your doctor's appointment. It'll talk to you. It's linked in with all your other devices, and they're all like that. They're not like identical, but they've all kind of like figured out a template that works. It's just crazy to see them run with Tesla's ideas. And by the way, Tesla didn't show up this year. Even though they launched the new Model Y in China, they didn't have a stand at Shanghai. And that was kind of a mistake in my mind, because I talked to a lot of people who were like, yeah, Tesla's played out. It's a static brand. It's like people only buy it because they like Elon Musk or because they're getting a deal. So like they're kind of hurting there too. And one of our frequent flyer sources, Tu Lei, who founded Sino Auto Insights, which is a market research firm that focuses on China, he goes, it's not too surprising. Tesla has nothing new to show, and it would have been very difficult for them to stand out in any significant way.
Yeah, I mean, look at it. Like, it would be, to me, it feels like it would be embarrassing. Like, you show up with your, we have a new Model Y. And it's like, okay, like, you know, all these, like you have a, we have a thousand other, maybe not a thousand, but you know, we've got 50 other car companies here that each have something crazy and new to show.
Yeah.
And the Model Y has like been on the market for years. So it kind of doesn't surprise me that they weren't going to be there.
Yeah. And it's like, why buy a Model 3? Like they make a car that Kevin and I were really like, we didn't get to drive it. It's called the Onvo L60. And this is from like the company NIO that does battery swapping, which we'll talk about in a minute. This is like their budget brand. And I sat in this thing and I'm like, it's great. It was kind of originally a rideshare car, but they took it on and made it for consumers. And it's like long and comfortable inside, but it's priced like a Toyota Corolla. It's like 17 grand or 20 grand or something. Front wheel drive looks really cool. And it's like this way undercuts a Model Y and a Model 3. There's a billion crossovers that are better than that. They have electric minivans. They have electric, like, seven-seat SUVs. They have electric convertibles. Like, it's just everything that we think Tesla should be doing, it's like these Chinese companies have already done it and are doing more of it.
Yeah, so it sounds like the cars are kind of like, you know, in America and in the West, car companies are still figuring out, how do we make software that's, like, a good user interface?
Yeah.
That like feels kind of like, you know, Apple-like, like iPad-like. How do we make something that just is like satisfying to use? And that's kind of where Tesla and Rivian are. And they also have some interesting, you know, some more forward-thinking features like, you know, the dog mode or like being able to control your car through an app in pretty deep ways. But it sounds like the Chinese like are way, way ahead of that.
Yeah, they've got that dialed in. And it was also fascinating to actually drive some of these cars, which we will talk about. But like, they don't feel like startup efforts. And like no offense to our pals and listeners like Lucid or Rivian or even Tesla. But like, there are areas where those companies feel like startups. Like, I love the Rivian R1T. It still had like creaks and rattles and, okay, you're a little new at making vehicles, but you'll get it right someday to it, as awesome and advanced as that vehicle is. Like, none of the Chinese EVs I drove, felt like startup efforts. Like they felt like stuff from companies that knew what they were doing and have been doing it a long time because they are and they have. Like, it just feels like, yeah, this is what we've done for years. And of course, we've gotten it right. Like any BMW or Chevy or Toyota you'd buy in America. Like, it's not like, okay, this is like everything that's electric in America is kind of a first or second draft. This is like the third book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what did you think? You know, I think one of the big things that we hear a lot is like the quality is super good. And that's doubly impressive because the prices, like, they're not exactly, you can't exactly equate like Chinese market prices to US market prices because like they couldn't just go and sell a BYD that sells for $10,000 in China. It probably wouldn't sell for $10,000 here because
totally
tariffs and other types of stuff. But like, what was your general impression of the quality? Like, is this, when you get in a Zeekr or something, is that like BMW level quality? Is it more mid-tier, you know, car company level quality? How would you kind of rank these?
I sat in one car that I thought had, you know, really kind of cheap plastics and that really harsh industrial grade, like, you know, dashboard plastic you find in every cheap car in America.
Yeah.
That car was a Volkswagen ID4.
Oof.
The rest were like such a cut above. Like the Chinese, they like really soft materials. They like colorful interiors. Like they all had this kind of like the dashboard blends into the doors, blends into the steering wheel design wise. Like it's, everything's really soft, really cushy seats. Like they're in traffic all the time there. They have to deal with potholes. Like they don't have like a history of like back road driving or motorsports the way that we do. So like, you know, if you have a car, it's like, it's gotta be comfortable because like, it's going to be your third space. They call it, there's like your home, your office and the vehicle you're in a lot of the time. It's why these cars do karaoke and stuff. Like, you gotta be entertained when you're stuck in Shanghai or Beijing traffic. And I saw both and they suck. It's like every city is like New York City in terms of traffic there, or LA or something. So yeah, I was very impressed by the quality. I want to wait till Kevin's back to talk about like the actual cars we drove, because that's like his jam and he's driving more of them. But there's one that I really liked of the Geely Group cars, and it was called the Lincoln Co. 900, and it was a plug-in hybrid. I don't really like plug-in hybrids, but I loved this thing. It was like this big kind of Range Rover-ish three-row SUV with a big battery, like a 53 kilowatt-hour battery, and a 2-liter turbo engine. So it's sort of the reverse of what our plug-in hybrids are like. It drove mostly like an EV, and you'd only feel the gas and like hard acceleration. But you know, had this huge screen that sweeps across the entire dashboard, and it's rated at 900 miles of range between the gas engine and the battery. And I was like, tell me this wouldn't do well in America, right?
Yeah. Plug-in hybrids are, you know, here a plug-in hybrid is generally like, you know, it's kind of a cross between a hybrid and a gas car. You have a small battery that'll get you like anywhere from like maybe 10 to 30 miles of range. Which you can use to like get around town, but basically you're filling it up with gas and you're also using it as a gas car. This is like the next level of that, which is we're going to give you a big, like a real EV size battery. So you can actually like do almost everything on electric power. And then you can like drive sometimes on gas, right?
Yeah, there was one rep I talked to, because I'm not going to quote who this person was. I'll probably get him in trouble. But I was like, yeah, I don't like plug-in hybrids. I told him, like, I'd rather have a regular hybrid or an EV. I don't really see the point. And he goes, that's because you've only driven American ones. Okay, cool. And he was right, you know?
Yeah, so you mentioned that that this car you think would do well in America. Do you think that in general, these Chinese cars, like, say we, you know, got rid of, because like, the big kind of looming, you know, cloud here is that you can't get these cars here because there are enormous tariffs on Chinese EVs.
Yeah.
Trump installed them. Biden raised them. We can't get them here. Do you think they would do well here?
Yeah, I think so many of them would. I mean, like I was looking at like the Zeekr lineup, and it's all crossovers and a couple of sporty sedans and bigger sedans. I'm like, this feels tailor-made for us because these buyers have such similar preferences. And when you look at history, right, when the Japanese auto industry entered this country, it actually took them a couple decades to really get it right. Like, Toyota started in the 50s with a car called the Toyopet Crown, And it failed so miserably, it almost killed that company. And today, it's like the stuff from the 60s, like the Honda S600 or S800. Like it's like a half step above a motorcycle. Like the only people that really remember those are like enthusiasts. It wasn't until, you know, the 70s and really being helped along by the gas crisis and the fact that they were smaller. And then the 80s, like they were like, okay, we know what Americans want and we're going to deliver it. Like China's ready to go right now. Like okay, man. Make sure the menus are in English and make sure like the cup holders can carry a big gulp and you're ready to rock, baby. Like it's these would do well if they were exported here could be made here and sold here.
So you drove these cars, you sat in them. Let's talk about EV charging and the kind of surrounding infrastructure, because you can't really sell or be successful at cars if you can't charge them. So what were your thoughts there?
Bad news, Tim. This is where China has us cooked too.
Oh man.
I know it's like, this is where my brain broke. And there's two examples of this. First is I try NIO's battery swapping. We did a story on this last year. Kevin has tried it a couple times, but I hadn't tried for myself while I was there. And you want to explain what that is while I have some water?
Yeah. So battery swapping is an alternative to plugging your car and charging it. So basically, I mean, you'll tell me how this actually worked in person, but essentially you pull up to the station and it robotically, kind of automatically, drops the battery out of the bottom of your car and swaps in a fully charged one. That's basically the idea.
Yeah, exactly. And like the car obviously has to be built for it. Like I couldn't do this to like my Kia, but like NIO's cars pretty much do this across the board. And NIO's the one pioneering the battery swapping. They've got over 3,000 of those stations just in China. They're adding some in Europe right now. They want to do a lot more. And it kind of looks like a car wash almost. Like you pull up to it, there's like a little box on the ground that's marked there. When you pull into that box, like the car knows where it is, and then a little menu comes up and you hit start, and that's it. That's all you do. The car automatically backs itself into the station, like autonomously. A robot platform comes out from the floor, removes the bottom of your car, removes the battery, slides that out, and then it happens in reverse, and you get a fresh new battery, and it's like drilled in, and the car's running some basic functions like the AC or the radio while you're doing this, and again, it sort of vibrates a little bit like you're in a car wash, and like 4 minutes later or less on the newer generations of these stations, you get a fresh new battery and you're ready to go.
Yeah, and you just drive out and go about your day with now like a 99 or 100% full battery, right?
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things here is from a kind of energy point of view, I think this is really interesting because like one of the problems with fast charging stations is they need a shit ton of power to them. And you need to, that in order to charge your car quickly. The interesting part of battery swapping is the batteries themselves get charged up super slowly. It's just like a regular, probably like a regular kind of power supply. You charge up the batteries slowly and then you put them in fast. It's kind of a completely different way of thinking about refueling. And we do have a startup trying to do this in America. There's one I'm aware of. Maybe there's more. There's one called Ample, which has kind of been stuck in pilot mode, I think, for years. So
yeah,
this is something that is, you know, potentially going to happen in America. But right now it's limited to, you know, the people that participate in this pilot. And it seems like we've kind of really hitched our wagon more so to fast charging.
Yeah, and I was on a call with, I was talking to my father about this too, and he was like, "This is so cool," but it's like, but it sounds like, you know, it has to be like an automaker that does this, that rolls it out. It, you know, it's like, and then if all, you're stuck using their battery, their technology, and then they could license it out, right? And I'm like, yes, exactly. Like that's exactly what NIO's doing. Like NIO's going to be working with other automakers soon to roll that out, and just the way Tesla did with supercharging. It's like this is the proprietary thing. But eventually it could go to everyone. And I talked to some reps at NIO who said that like there are people on their staff who only do battery swapping. Like there's like, I never charge my car anymore. I just do that when I need to. And that's their experience with EVs. So it's really pretty wild, right?
So what about the charging? You also charged a car. How did that go?
Tim, I charged the hell out of a car. You're hearing it here first. This took some doing while we were in China, but Inside EVs is, I believe, the first Western outlet to experience BYD's megawatt charging. And you hear it here first in the podcast, but there, let's go, baby. I know this is what gets me out of bed every day. And it's, that's going to be on our YouTube channel and on the website in the coming days once it's done. But a few weeks ago, Chinese giant BYD made waves. They announced that they have a breakthrough called 5-minute EV fast charging or megawatt charging, because it's 1,000 kilowatts. And we covered this on the podcast on March 21st, and it made a lot of waves in America. Like I was surprised at the degree to which this made like wider news. Like NPR, Bloomberg, and like the nightly news were writing about it. So it kind of blew up. Well, I talked my way into going there. That's why I flew to Beijing. Like they had a demonstration with Chinese media only, and like we begged, borrowed, cajoled, and BYD was very accommodating and let us join them. Wasn't a junket, by the way. I paid for that hotel out of my own pocket, just so you know how dedicated I was to getting the story. But we did it. We've seen it, baby. It's real.
So I don't know if you want to spoil the video, but like, how did it go?
No, I'll spoil it. Absolutely. It was, so the way that this works is it's right now megawatt charging, 1000 kilowatt charging. If you want some context, like, you know, kilowatts, if you're new to this stuff, the speed at which your EV will charge up, like my Kia will do 250 is kind of the max speed. Tesla's about 250 is the max speed. Chevy Equinox EV, very good car. Otherwise 150 kilowatts is the max speed. So we're talking, 10 times about what an Equinox can do. Right now it's on BYD's new e-Power platform, which is on two cars called the Han L sedan and the Tang L SUV, named after the famous Chinese dynasties, because BYD's got big plans for the world. And it's
super,
not just
super e-platform, super e-platform,
super e-platform. Yes. And like, it's not just faster chargers, the way this system works. It's an entire ecosystem that BYD has redesigned. It's the electrical architecture. It's the battery. It's the chargers itself. It's the systems within there to manage heat. You know, it's these cars, they have two fast charging ports on either side, two of them. And it's like, they will take two chargers at once, and they call this a gun. And, That's one innovation here. Then they redid the sensors and the chips. Like, there was this 6-page bullet list they sent me of all the stuff they did. Like, one excerpt: materials across electrolytes, separators, and electrodes have been optimized to create ultra-fast ion channels, reducing internal resistance by 50%. So, like, all this stuff was made in-house by BYD. In-house. Like, Chinese car companies are already like super vertically integrated, but BYD said like, we want to do this, and the technology to do it didn't exist, so we made it ourselves.
Yeah, so you charged twice. The first time you used the dual gun, gun technology, right?
Yeah, or rather, I was like there filming it while the BYD reps set up all these cars for us. It was like a couple dozen cars, and they came to us with low batteries, and we plugged them in. The first time we plugged in two 250 kilowatt chargers at once at the same time, and at 250 kilowatts, like that's common ish in America. It's on the faster end for us. Like that's a pretty fast charger, right? Like. Way more common in China, but like if you could find a stall where, you know, you could use two plugs at once, you plug it in, and this thing jumped to 400 kilowatts right away, which I had never seen anything that fast in my life. And just got beaten later in the day, and it went from 15% to 25% in, by my math, about a minute. So yeah, that alone was an amazing breakthrough. And that's before we get to megawatt charging. Then we went to a BYD dealer, and megawatt, the 1,000 kilowatts, that works off a single gun, a single charging. Plug that in. What I saw was it went from 3% to 60% in under 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts. I will say, like, it makes sense that they deplete it, right? So like your car in general is going to charge. Sorry, I'm like being like a negative Nancy, but
no, please
your
do.
Car, your car is always going to charge way faster when it's at like a very low state of charge versus when it's higher. So that's the reason that they set these cars up to start at like 3%. But
yeah,
still,
if it's like 70%, it's not going to do that kind of magic. But like still, right, it was just, I saw the graph on the car that every EV owner knows where you just like, you're sitting there watching your percentage tick up, you know, you're at the grocery store or whatever, or, you know, you're on your phone. And I just saw it just fill up like that. And it was just insane to see that. And like, I should also note the Han L and Tang Hell come in plug-in hybrid form, and they're also great. The EV versions do 0 to 60 in 2.7 seconds. I did a couple of runs in it and scared the hell out of me. It also has the BYD's autonomous driving system, or autonomous assistance system called God Eye. It's the best I've ever used in my career. Wow. And like even 15 minutes of driving in Beijing traffic or in the city and on the highway, I was like, this is smarter and more confident and smoother than anything I've driven in the US. So it was wild, you know?
Yeah. And so tell me, what was that like? Is God's Eye like a Tesla FSD sort of system where it is trying to pilot you in any situation, city, streets, highway, or is this mainly a highway, you know, cruise control type thing?
So the way this works in China right now, like totally hands-off driving is banned by the government. Like I suppose it's technically capable by most of these companies, but it is not allowed. And about a month ago, there was a really horrific crash in China that killed three university students. The car was in autonomous assistance mode and switched off and then immediately crashed into a concrete barrier and killed three people, which is it's really tragic. It's horrific. And so like the government is like bringing the hammer down on these systems right now. And so like there, that was a lot of the talk at the auto show was, what do we do about this? But all of the Chinese cars, like to my knowledge, at least most of the ones I saw, they come with LiDAR on the roof. Like that's, I had a freak out moment earlier because I was at a Zeekr dealership. It's like, oh, this has LiDAR. Is that standard? And he was like, yeah, like all our cars have LiDAR. Why wouldn't they? And I'm like, oh my God, Jesus. Like, this is like this blows up the Tesla thesis because they're like, we don't need LiDAR. It's too expensive. And we can do this with cameras and AI and software and no other sensors. And China's like, yeah, you say that, but like, we're doing it right now. And like, we're putting LiDAR on like Toyota Corolla grade cars. And that's how blown my mind was by this experience. And I want to say during this BYD briefing, there was this moment where they're talking about how they had to develop all this technology themselves and how they ensured safety for it and everything. And I'm just following along. It's all in Mandarin. And I got the PR guy next to me. He's very helpful. He's whispering in my ear in English. Like, okay, now he's saying this, this, and this. I'm following along. And I'm just, yes, silicon carbide. Yes, I'm sure. But in my mind, I'm just like, I'm freaking screaming. I'm like, how did we get rolled so hard here, Tim? Like, how did we get so left behind? How is this country so far ahead? Like, why are our car companies struggling to catch up? How'd they not see this coming? Like, why do we not have this stuff? After all this time, all this talk about going all electric, these car companies, what do they have for us besides, like, gas pickup trucks and excuses? Like, my soul left my body, and I had to, like, retrieve it in so that I could, you know, get back to work. But, like, I'm joking, but it's like this industry and American buyers and the American people and American policymakers need to realize, like, we are not competitive anymore. We are behind. Like, we are a developing market when it comes to the technology of the future. We're like one of those countries you go to where the most popular car on the road is like a diesel Land Cruiser from the 80s that they still make today for some reason. Like, we're in a situation where the American consumer does not have the best things on offer. And when was the last time that happened? Sometime in the 20th century, like before World War II, maybe. Like, we're not a technological leader anymore. And maybe you're like thrilled about Chinese cars and you really want them to come here, or maybe you want America to catch up because you have no interest in supporting, you know, China or that government or, you know, the trajectory that country's on. But like, that situation should scare everyone. because it you know, it's not good, Tim. That's not good.
Yeah, and on top of all that, the tariffs are only getting more intense, right? Especially on China. Like, we see all this happening. We've been screaming about it forever. You are now going from, you know, screaming to shrieking to shriek mode.
Yeah.
And yet the decision isn't like, okay, let's like kick our shit into high gear. It's
right.
How do we wall ourselves off even more from this like inevitable tsunami, right?
Yeah. And I think that's only going to work for so long. And I think that's also what's insane about like the tariff situation too. Like, I just drove the most advanced cars I have ever seen in a dozen years of covering this industry. And I come home and like, we don't know where to build cars or how much they're going to cost. And no one knows how to plan for the future anymore because of this like harebrained idea of like shock reshoring American manufacturing like overnight. Yeah. Meanwhile, China races ahead with this stuff, you know, like that again, it should scare everyone. And I will tell you too, like, I want to address this more with Kevin next week. Like this market, I'm not here to simp for China, right? Like, I don't have a dog in this fight besides wanting, like, you know, just knowing how important the automotive sector is to America. But like, the Chinese market has its weaknesses. There are too many brands. There are too many car companies. They're competing for like an ever-shrinking pool of buyers. Most of them aren't profitable yet. And they're going to have to be at some point. Like, we talked about how China's government like bootstrapped a lot of this, but like, the check is coming due. Like, they expect a return on that investment as any investor would. And like, I know that not all of those brands I saw out there like are going to survive and that this bubble's going to burst. But if our plan is to just like wait for that day, that's like being in a bar fight and saying, well, like, my plan is to wait for the other guy to die of natural causes. And that's a shitty plan. It's like, what we need to do is like grab a beer bottle, smack him over the head as hard as we can and get out of there before the cops show up. Which as you and I would know is how bar fights work. But like,
speaking from experience.
Yeah. But we do this all the time together. It's just, it's what we do at SIVs, but it's like, what's the plan here? What is the plan? Is it just like, is to hope that they just like, tariffs and national security concerns can wall those companies off long enough for our companies to catch up? I'm not sure I see that happening. I see our car companies slowing down. And I see that the tariff policies forcing them to slow down more. Even if these brands don't all survive for the future, like the underlying technology is still there. Megawatt charging is still there. Battery swapping is still there. LiDAR that's this advanced is still there. Like, that's gonna go somewhere. And it's like, I don't see that going away, even if XPeng or Zeekr or whatever fold into some other bigger conglomerate at some point.
Yeah, and we were talking about this the other day. It's like, even if a lot of these companies fail, which they will, because
yeah,
we have, you know, they have too many brands. They have over capacity, too much production capacity for the number of cars that they're able to sell. Even if some of these brands go away, like, okay, then you have, it seems to me, a bunch of like basically ex startup veterans who are going to go to these, you know, existing companies, the companies that survive, and just like help make them better. It's like if you had, it's like how Tesla in America totally seeded the, you know, American EV movement, how Lucid and Rivian and even the big traditional OEMs, they're all staffed up by these ex Tesla people. It's like, okay, some of these Chinese startups go away, but you have like all this amazing talent, I would imagine, that's just going to like flood into the ones that survive. So
yeah, you have an entire country of that. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's a 5-alarm fire and we're the dog of that meme sitting there saying everything is fine. And like, I don't know. I walked away from this mad. Like, Kevin has told me this before. It's like, you get mad when you go there because you get mad at the complacency that our car companies and America have had. And like, I guess instead we get excited for more air pollution and irrelevance, folks. Like, that's the path we're on. And that's part of it too. It's not just better cars. It's like, we are in a climate crisis. We are in a pollution crisis. And like, China has like, to its credit, mitigated a lot of that, including with the prevalence of electrified vehicles. And like, we have the chance to do the same and we're not. And like, our people and our people's health childhood asthma, you name it, is going to just, you know, suffer because of this complacency. And I don't know, that's going to be a hell of a reckoning when that day comes, you know?
It's like all this is happening. And it's China that's leading the charge toward like all these industries that are going to remake the future, electric cars, solar panels, all that kind of stuff, batteries. Anyway, I can't wait to go to the Chinese auto show next year so I can come back equally outraged.
Oh yeah, we're sending your ass to Beijing next year for the next auto show, Tim. Get excited. I do need you to start learning Mandarin in the meantime. Don't worry, it's not hard. It's a very easy language to learn, famously.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, how hard can it be? Now that I'm done yelling for a while, it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world this week. Tim, who you got for me?
This week, my plus is me, Patrick.
It's hell
me,
yeah.
And also the rest of the Inside EVs team. We covered, I think, the shit out of the Slate truck reveal. It's not every day that you get a brand new EV startup that hits the map. We did a great video on it that I starred in, and it got like 700 plus thousand views, over 700,000 views, which I'm very proud of.
Yeah, that's a heck of a win for our YouTube channel. And, you know, we don't do video as much as like some of the purely video players out there, but like we're working to do more. And this is like our biggest win ever because of Tim's incredible, like, hard work for sure. And also charisma. And we call him Timmy YouTubes at the office now. We were saying it yesterday and everything. We're getting t-shirts made. So yeah, congrats on that. And
I think it was small part talent, large part doing something mysterious that the YouTube algorithm liked. So thank you, YouTube.
Yeah, it's part of it's also, and I had to do this at the BYD thing. We have to do the thing where you're holding out your arms and being like, oh my God, look at the thing. And like, I'm like, I hate doing that because it's deeply embarrassing and I'm an adult man and I have dignity. But
yeah, you have to debase yourself. You have to debase yourself in order to make a great YouTube thumbnail, which I think I'm okay at.
Yeah, you did great. And like Mike Roselli, our video producer, has been like, no, like you have to do that, like for the algorithm. Like it knows if you didn't do the arm thing and it will punish you. So this is us bowing at the altar of Google, which is also our self-driving car master, turns out too. A lot of versatility there, you know? It's a real triple threat. My minus is the American consumer, because I've been to China now and we're screwed. The end. Well, thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Kevin Williams will be joining us from China, too, and to talk about some of the stuff that he experienced while he was there. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network.
Make sure to hit the follow button wherever you get your podcasts and send us your questions about the EV world to podcast@insideevs.com. See you next time.
Adios.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.